Welcome to the ABM Conversations Podcast, the number one podcast for B2B marketers wanting to explore timeless account-based marketing strategies to drive revenue, customer engagement, retention, and everything that makes sense to both marketers and sales folks. No more fluff. No more vanity metrics. Live from India, made for the world.
Hello and welcome to yet another brand new episode of the ABM Conversations podcast. And this is me, your host, Yag. In today's episode, we are going to discuss positioning, product messaging, and value proposition, and how to do it right. And to discuss that and dive deep into the topic, we have with us the one and only Pep Laya, the founder and CEO of Winter and CXL. For starters, Winter focuses on analyzing and improving your product messaging, whereas CXL trains marketers to get to the top 1%. Pep is also a board member of Spiro, which was previously known as CXL Agency. He is exactly the kind of founder that we love, an absolute no-fluff guy. He has been on the trenches, running experiments and optimization for businesses, and now is growing the portfolio of companies that I just mentioned. Pep, welcome to the show, brother. How are you?
Oh, thanks, Yag. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Same here. Right, Pep, let's get going. You know, let's start with talking about the vanilla language and sameness that we see across different products belonging to the same category. You know, there's something interesting that you mentioned on LinkedIn recently that caught my eye. You said, if the messaging in your ads sounds like something your competitor might say, the customers might actually attribute it to them. So yes, if I say we are a CRM, people are going to think of Salesforce or probably HubSpot for that matter. But it's also true that every mature industry is going to have one hegemon and a lot of atomized companies in the long tail, like say an Amazon and a lot of similar looking smaller e-commerce companies. So in such a scenario where there are certain things that are considered to be table stakes, how do you feed the sameness and differentiate your product or service?
That's a million-dollar question, man. Differentiation is just not easy anymore. I mean, back in the day, it used to be that you could just be different by just one thing. But now, with the barriers of entry being the lowest ever in basically every industry, you know, from manufacturing to SaaS, not to mention services, it's just so easy for anybody to come in and also do the same thing. So being different from others in the marketplace has become very, very hard. And so when you ask, how can you be different? I mean, that there's a 1 hour answer in there.
Right. I'm totally with you on that. And I also think a lot of the sameness comes from, you know, focusing too much on the competition than on one's own product or vision. So maybe let me add one parameter here and ask you this. So do you see a correlation between the number of companies in an industry and the sameness among the products and messaging?
Absolutely. And I think it's based on two things. So first of all, original thought is rare. So very few people have an original idea or original vision for what to do and how to do it. Most people do two things. They, one, look at what your competitors are doing. And so your competitor becomes your, you know, first prototype, so to speak. And also, all smart companies do consumer research. They talk to users that have a problem. So, for instance, if you're selling minivans, you talk to moms about, hey, how do they use their car and what are their needs with their car? And the problem with that is that everybody who is in the same category is solving with the exact same problems. And by solving for the exact same problems and looking at your competition, inevitably you end up with the exact same product as well.
Right. And I think there's also a flip side to this. In many ways, differentiation also starts with your positioning. What I mean is that you want people to put you in a specific box or compare with players in a specific category. For example, when Drift came into the scene, they wanted to play in the live chat and chatbot category like Intercom. But the big difference, however, is that they positioned themselves differently. You know, they were all about conversational marketing, whereas Intercom was primarily positioned towards customer engagement and customer support. So can you talk to us about what positioning means to you? Do you look at it from, you know, what's the value proposition to the customer, or does it come from the place of how am I different from the competition?
Yeah, so positioning would be, first of all, it requires a very well-defined set of customers that you're trying to appeal to. So that's one. So define the market segment that you're trying to win in. And two, then how are you the best choice for this one well-defined segment? So positioning says what use case is your product for what type of customers? So, you know, this can be live chat for salespeople or live chat for support people. This will be a different kind of positioning. And obviously, positioning is definitely your foundation for how to be different. So once you've defined your segment that you want to compete in, you do have to look at who else is competing for that same segment. Who else is basically an alternative? Who can the customer use? And you need to be in some ways be different or better. And it's very hard to be better, because name a company or a brand that is just objectively, factually better than the competition. It's very hard to answer it. Like, is HubSpot factually, objectively better than some other CRM? I don't know. Like, you can't count, like, oh, they have more integrations, which might be a fact, or they have some other thing. But like, if you look at the like CRMs or email marketing tools, 99% of them do exactly the same things. So the differences are super subtle. And also, if you do have a feature that is differentiated, give competitors a year and they'll all have it as well. You know, same happened with, you mentioned Link, Drift and Intercom. They used to be very, very different. Now they're basically exactly the same things. Yes, the messaging is still different. So, and that's what I think one should optimize for is differentiation through brand, differentiation through what you say about yourself, your point of view about the world and the way things should be.
Right, right. That makes a lot of sense. In fact, I personally believe a lot in building and setting the narrative for my products. Because many a time, it so happens that if you don't set the narrative or get your messaging right, either your customers or the analyst firms are going to be quick to put you in a box that you don't want to be in. Feel free to correct me, if I'm wrong here. I've always felt that although you can get your story sorted by talking to a customer, you need to be the person who takes control of it, even if it is going to contribute to a little bit of cognitive disfluency. So can you talk to like who in a company should be actually owning the product messaging, and how can one get their message right?
Well, the way I think about differentiation of messaging and narratives is that this is not like a line of copy your marketing person writes. So like, yeah, let's build the product and now, you know, sprinkle some differentiation on top of it. That's not how it really works, because that's just superficial differentiation and is not going to go anywhere. So really, it needs to be part of the core DNA and strategy of your overall company, which means that the CEO owns differentiation. And same with positioning, obviously in collaboration with the whole leadership team. The tactical implementation of this, you know, might be, you know, depending on the organization, might be marketing, product marketing, different functions. But ultimately, like, where you compete and how you win of super strategic decisions, and then absolutely the CEO needs to own that and get alignment with the rest of the leadership team, that every single person in the company is on the same page of like, how are we competing and how are we winning and why should companies use us and what is our story that we tell? It's hard actually.
Right, right. And then you put the customers and customer logos into the scene, then the thing totally changes. For example, let me talk about the usage of customer stories or customer logos as part of the messaging and storytelling. For example, when you read a case study that says something like, we've had a 128% growth in XYZ using product A, you immediately understand that it's written by a marketer because no customer talks like that. And secondly, I also see a general perception or belief that you tend to put the most well-known logos on your homepage just to show off and validate yourself. So I think there are two sides to this. Yes, you want to have a Microsoft or a Facebook logo on your homepage, and that does look cool. But it also, you know, especially if you are a SaaS company targeting the SMB market, you're going to shoo away a lot of prospective customers because they're going to think that, hey, you're all about enterprise and maybe you're not for us. Which goes back to the original discussion of, you know, alienating or differentiating yourselves the way you express yourself. So how can one really make the best use of customer stories to further their cause in terms of messaging or in terms of positioning?
Yeah, I think the logos, the social proof is not really part of the messaging. It's, if anything, it's just signaling what kind of company are we for. So if you have a well-defined segment that you compete in, you do want to show logos from basically the same type of company. So if you want to attract more of those companies, you know, they'll say, oh yeah, looks like it's for us. But it's not really a company story. I mean, you could company story is still something else. So I don't see social proof as being the same thing. Sure, you could, you know, in your social media marketing and, you know, those type of things, you could, you know, highlight customer stories and like how the customer had a success using product or whatever the case may be. Company narrative is still something else. I personally really love the way Andy Raskin talks about this in terms of like, what is the change happening in the world and how you need a strategy to cope with this change. And, you know, our solution basically is how to adapt to this. Obviously, this applies to the B2B scenario. Consumer products are different.
Right. Maybe, you know, can you take us through your thought process of the way you've gone about positioning and messaging of Winter, CXL, and Spiro? You know, I remember going through the tweet thread about why CXL agency became Spiro. Mm-hmm. But for the sake of our audience who are primarily B2B marketers and sales, you know, sales folks in the SaaS environment, can you throw some light on what is the relationship between Winter, CXL, and Spiro and how each of these are positioned differently? Mm-hmm.
So I started CXL 10 years ago, and at first it was a conversion optimization agency, and then years later we added on like a brand extension that we called CXL Institute, an e-learning company, and then things became kind of fuzzy. People were kind of confused. So what is CXL about? Are we an agency or are we an e-learning company? Because it's very hard for a brand to stand for two ideas at once. As also CXL, the agency was a conversion optimization agency, but with CXL Institute, we were more broad, like all aspects of marketing. And so it became increasingly confusing for the marketplace to put us in a box and for us to really adequately communicate what we are about. So we made a decision to split these brands off into separate brands. And we decided to spin off the agency into its own brand, really. And along with just renaming the company, which is kind of like the more superficial part of this, is that we also changed the positioning and like the focus of the company from conversion optimization to customer experience optimization. So this has to do with, so we chose this angle as our new, you know, let's say positioning. Is because the way the world has changed. The world has changed from quick metrics like conversion rate and like signups to more like retention metrics, customer lifetime value, and then your churn rate and retention rate. So the company's profitability is really driven by retention, and acquiring new customers is 5 to 25 times more expensive than retaining your existing ones. So the world has changed, and then in the VC money, VC companies give a lot more valuation to companies that have strong retention rates. So essentially, we are living in what we call a retention economy. It's everything is retention-based now. And so we need to move away from short-term metrics and towards long-term metrics, like retention rate and lifetime value. And so given that the world has changed around us, focusing on something like conversion rate optimization, it's just silly, because conversion rate, you know, like if you just want to inflate that one metric, that's just going to give you maybe good results in the very short term, but definitely suffering in the long run. And so based on the external world changed, we said the strategy that you as a company need to stay competitive has to change. And so you need to focus on this retention-focused metrics. And that is how we position the new agency as well, that we're going to help you win in this new world that we call the retention economy. And then CXL, we dropped the institute and became just an e-learning company called CXL.
Right. And where does Winter fall into the scheme of things?
So Winter is not really related to CXL and Spiro, other than just me being the founder of all of these companies. So Winter is a tool we launched 2020 May as copy testing. It was called copy testing. And we thought that essentially what Winter does is that we take your copy and put it in front of the audience you are trying to sell to or market to and tell you how they perceive it, what they think about it, what's clear, unclear, what resonates, what turns people off about your copy, your messaging. And so when we launched it as copy testing, we learned three things. First of all, we learned that we were wrong about the target audience that we thought is going to be drawn to it. So we thought this is going to be mainly for copywriters. In fact, actually, we learned that parable audience for us, because most copywriters are actually not data-driven and not really interested in becoming one. Even feeling threatened by data offering, let's say, a judgment on their work. And two, copywriters really don't have money. And also, we thought it's consumer companies that are going to be very interested in, especially e-commerce. And we were also wrong, because what we learned was that once e-commerce companies launch, let's say, new product pages, they never think about the copy again. And obviously, I'm generalizing here. There are exceptions. And in SaaS companies, copy is often thought of as something that your entry-level marketing people do. You know, it's like this new guy, Jack, he started last week. Let him write the copy. You know, like it's not anything your senior marketing person really thinks about. Obviously, the senior people, the marketing leadership and the CEO, they control the budget. So we had kind of a problem where we were trying to sell to people who are not really interested in our product, and they didn't really have money. And the people with money, they didn't really care about copy. So it was like a really a conundrum for us in terms of product market fit. But then there was a segment of companies that started to show interest in us, and that was B2B SaaS companies, which is our main our core audience, and marketing agencies as well. And then after countless number of demos and interviews, we learned that, okay, we have to change our positioning. And in fact, we need to change our brand as well. Because also the word with the brand name we chose initially, copy testing, is just a weak brand name. Because in SaaS, you cannot compete on features. We briefly mentioned that. Because in the end, the competitors will catch up, they'll copy you, and then your main competitive advantage is you're competing on brand. And copy testing, which is a literal descriptive name, is a weak brand name. So when people talk about your area, your field, your industry, it's very hard to separate. Are they talking about your business or your brand? And so it's harder to gain foothold. And also, a literal descriptive brand name instantly positions you as like this mundane, commonplace, basically a commodity. And you don't want to be a commodity. And so that was one. We knew we needed a name change. So we went with Winter. Two, we wanted to change the conversation. So while the marketing leadership, they don't care about copy, they care very much about value propositions. They care about the narrative. They care about positioning and messaging. So we just flipped the conversation and starting to talk about what we do in those terms. So ideas like message market fit, ideas like testing whether your messaging works, your product messaging, and that basically made us instantly attractive to a whole new audience. So changing the way we talk about what we do, changing the name, and also then changing basically the type of companies that we're going after from direct to consumer e-commerce and going after B2B SaaS and agencies instead.
Right. I think that makes a lot of sense, and that gives a deeper perspective of how you thought about things and the way you executed. All right. So that brings us to, that segment of our podcast, which is more like a fun game show we call the Rapid Fire section. And the idea of Rapid Fire is to ask you quick pointed questions and try to put you on the spot and see how it goes from there. So I'm going to ask you 5 pointed questions, and your answers need not be short. You can just go with the flow, whatever comes to your mind. So are you up for it?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So here's question number 1. I'm going to pick this up purely from what you just said. You spoke about something called message market fit. Can you explain what that is?
So before people sign up with your product and decide whether they like your product, they need to be interested and curious enough about your product to begin with. And that is all about messaging, the way you communicate about your product. So message market fit really is whether your messaging clicks with your audience. Your audience, as they read the copy, they read what you're saying about yourself, and they're like, they nod their heads. It's like, yes, I want that. Or like, I resonate with what you're saying. I want that. Because the main idea is to make them want that. So product market fit cannot exist without message market fit first. Message market fit leads to product market fit.
Right, right. That makes total sense. All right. So here's question number 2. We believe that a brand stands for only one thing in the mind of the customer. So do you agree or disagree, and why?
I absolutely agree. It's just people don't spend a lot of time thinking about brands at all. So if your brand is many ideas, you are about sustainability and also you are about wellness of people, then it's like, well, it's hard. Well, like, what are you even about? And then it's just hard for your messaging or your message to just reach people. It's harder for people to put you in a box, because people want to put you in a box, and you should let them. And this is because we are all bombarded all day long with various marketing messages all day long. And so thinking fast and slow, most of the time our brain is on autopilot. And so people don't really pause to think about you. And so you want them to make it easy to label you something. And if your brand stands for multiple ideas, it's just confusing. And it's just, they'll just rather ignore you rather than put you in a box and think about you. So standing for a single idea is increasing cognitive fluency. It's easier for people to understand what you're about. And that's a good thing.
Right. I'm totally with you on that. All right. So here's question number 3. As a continuous experimenter, I'm sure you've had your fair share of costly experiments that didn't go well. So how has that changed the way you run experiments right now?
Most costly ones are related to software development. So when you're, building a SaaS product and you are spending your multiple weeks, maybe even months of your developer team time on building features, And then you release these features to the market, and then you learn that actually they don't want to use these features. They don't care about them. They're not signing up because of these features, and they don't even want to use these features. Then you wasted thousands and thousands of dollars of money, and there's a big opportunity cost as well. Like, you could have been building something else. So that's one mistake. Second is that, related, you're building a product that nobody wants. At CXL, which is an e-learning company, we build training products. So they're, recruit an instructor, work on a curriculum, book a studio time, film, edit, all that stuff, post-production. You know, a lot of people involved, a lot of money and time. And then you produce a new training product, and then they don't want to buy. Oops, you know. So to avoid these costly mistakes, basically, I am now all about smoke tests as well as no-code, low-code solutions. So for software development, before we build a new feature, what we do is we figure out a way to offer the value that this feature we are thinking about would offer. And we offer this feature through part manual labor and part using no-code or low-code tools. So as an example, when we're working on this new tool inside Winter, which is audience research. So in Winter, we have a lot of panels that you can tap into audiences. So let's say you are selling to CMOs and you want to know how CMOs think about whatever you're selling. Let's say you sell content marketing services. So how are CMOs thinking about content marketing services? You want to survey the CMOs, understand how to think about it, what are the perceived problems, what are the wishes, pains they want to avoid, gains they want to have. And so that's the new service we're working on. Before I went to the development team and said, hey, guys, let's now scope this feature out and let's build this. What we did was I just said, hey, is anybody there who wants to try this service? And so what we did was I just used Typeform, an existing survey software, and I sent the link to a Typeform survey that I built out to our panelists by hand over email. And then they filled out the survey, and then we transferred the survey data, you know, to the customer basically by hand. So using some tools and a lot of manual labor behind the scenes, and we had what we verified by doing this is is there a customer that actually wants to pay for this? Because, you know, if you just survey people, hey, would you like this? Would you pay for this? They'll say yes, but when it's time to actually pay up the money, often they don't. So now we had customers who paid us money. Then we did the work, and then they had some sort of an opinion about the survey. And we learned actually many things about how the service actually should be. So for instance, we gave this pilot customer a quote how much we charge for it. And then they came back to us with the questions they wanted to ask the panelists, the audience. And it was a lot of questions. So a lot of questions means that the audience has to spend, you know, maybe 30 minutes filling out the survey. And we're paying the panelists a certain amount of money, and now we realize, oh, we need to pay them way more because the workload increased. So our insight was that, oh, when we productize this, we need to charge per question. Otherwise, they'll add as many questions as they can, you know? And so we learned about the product. We validated that we, you know, that somebody is ready to pay for this. Now we are ready to put this into production, because we know that people want this and we have a better idea of how it should work. And so, and smoke test at CXL when we, you know, launch new courses, what we even do is just we put up a sales page, maybe film a demo video of the product, of the course, and put a buy button on it and say, hey, buy this new product, and while we have actually not built it. And so we first actually verify whether people are going to pay for it. And when they do pay for it, we either tell them, hey, can you wait a couple of months? Or, you know, if they cannot, we'll just, we'll either offer them an alternative product or, you know, refund them. So this way, we are only building products that people want and are ready to pay for.
Right. What I love in what you just said is that it's not just validation, but it also gives you an insight into what would be the right kind of business model to have for that particular product. That's amazing. All right, so here's question number four. Recently, you made an amazing post on LinkedIn that said something like, it's a good idea to mention starting from pricing in your ads if you're expensive. So can you explain the idea behind that?
Yeah, so if you are an expensive product, and you know, I sell many expensive products, you know, our agency services are like monthly retainers are, you know, $20,000 and up. So if a lead comes in, first of all, let's say it's a paid ad. They click on an ad that costs us money. Then they schedule a call with one of my people. And they get on the phone call and they talk, you know, 30 to 60 minutes, and turns out that their budget is $500 total. And we're like, what? This call cost us more than $500. It was like, it's just a massive waste. And the cost per click is also not cheap. So you want to filter out tire kickers, people with low budget, you know, basically wrong audience by doing this. And also it works the other way, where it's like in my agency, and when we started 10 years ago, we were much cheaper. And also the leads that we got were from smaller companies. And one of the changes we did was for our lead, get a quote form, we put their pricing brackets, like basically give us an idea of what your budget is. We added some wildly bigger budget ranges than we actually were taking on clients, like, oh, this is $100,000 per project or whatever. And we instantly started getting higher quality leads, because if a big company comes in and it seems like all your services are like $500, $1,000, no self-respecting big company is ever going to take you seriously. They're like, oh, this is for like, you know, mom and pops. This is so cheap, it cannot possibly be good or sophisticated. So they want to pay more money. In fact, being the most expensive option in your category is usually a really good idea. And so, yeah, so leading with price, if you're expensive, brings you the right type of customer, or like the chances get bigger that you'll be the right, you know, they'll be the right type of lead.
Right. Access a qualifier. Right. So here's the final rapid fire question. Both you and I know that a lot of companies do content marketing the way HubSpot prescribed in 2010, you know, but now, are there any two or three companies in the SaaS space that you think right now they are doing really well?
Well, I think there's a lot of companies, that are killing it out there. Gong, you know, I think like anytime anybody talks about a company, they always say, oh, look at Gong, or, you know, like, there's an IPO announced every week, it seems, these days. So I'm not sure what to tell you here. Like thousands of companies that are like killing it.
Right. All right. So that brings us towards, the end of our show today. I got some amazing pointers, especially the way you run your experiments, and especially, the way you qualify your customers, and the whole idea behind the way you've built your company and differentiated all three of them, and the perfect reasoning that you had for it. So before I let you go, would you like to share a parting message with our audience?
My parting message for the audience would be that think about the category of products that you are in, and then go to G2 or Capterra or one of those, software review sites, Trust Radius, and then see how many competitors are there for your category. And I guarantee you, it's a lot. It's more than you would think. It's ridiculous amount of companies. And then, who are the market leaders? So you want to be as different as possible from the market leaders, companies that people know. So really focus on differentiation. Know that you cannot compete on features. I mean, you might need feature parity, yes, but ultimately you're competing on a point of view, on a narrative, on messaging, on your brand. So be really different than your category leaders. If you're a challenger brand and you're not obviously different than others in your category, it's going to be just a tough ride.
Right. And for the listeners of the podcast, if some of them want to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to connect with you, and what are the right reasons they can get in touch with you for?
Well, I'm very active on Twitter and LinkedIn. I'm there every day, so you can just come and ping me there, send me a message, send me a tweet. Happy to chat, connect with you on LinkedIn. So that will be the best place.
All right, that's amazing, and thank you so much, Pep, for all the wonderful share of knowledge that you did over the last 35 minutes or so. And to the listeners of the podcast, that's that from us for this episode, and we'll catch up with you once again next week with another topic. And until then, it's bye from me, Yag. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the ABM Conversations Podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share your comments with us. We're constantly looking for your feedback, thoughts, and suggestions to make the show more relevant to you.